Good evening and welcome to Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me tonight I have Fianna Fáil TD for Kildare North and party spokesperson on science and technology James Lawless, Fine Gael councillor for Dunleary Rathdown Barry Ward, Larry Donnelly, law lecturer for NUI Galway, Kate Shanahan, head of the School of Journalism and senior lecturer at Technological University Dublin, and Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times. We want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, we've had a delightful day here in RTE, as you can imagine, as we've heard and been hearing more about that plan to save the national broadcaster from financial ruin. 200 job cuts, pay freezes, pay cuts, review of benefits, work practice reforms, the closures of Airtel, digital radio stations and the Limerick studio, and the sale of more land are all in the mix. Minister of State at the Department of Finance, Patrick O'Donovan, questioned whether these cuts will add up to the savings required. Here he is talking to Mary Wilson on Drive Time earlier.
The only reason that the Limerick studio has been singled out and not any of the other regional studios is because the lease for this studio that I'm sitting in runs out on the 31st of December 2020. So we've been thrown under the bus by RTE for pennies, really, because the cost savings associated with closing the Limerick studio here, given that Dee Forbes says she has a €60 million hole, I'd love to see how discontinuing Airtel, which I didn't even realise was still around, or the RTE guide, or the Limerick studio thrown together. They're pennies in relative to what RTE are actually need. And the biggest question that I would have, Mary, to be honest about it, is how have RTE managed to get themselves into this situation in the first place?
And that was Patrick O'Donovan speaking earlier. And I was just listening to him again because he was on prime time as we were coming down to studio. And again, he was questioning, how did RTE get itself into this position? And saying, you know, that the big questions about why RTE has not grown its revenue since 2014. Barry Ward, does the minister not read the papers about the media landscape we are now all in?
Yeah, well, I suppose in the first place, Katie, I think RTE actually does great work. I think we sometimes in Ireland fall into the trap of comparing ourselves to the BBC, which is not just our nearest public service broadcaster, but probably the best one in the world. And it's not a fair comparison, given the disparity between the budgets, because I think BBC's daily budget is bigger than RTE's annual budget. But at the same time, I don't think it's fair to suggest that just because the media landscape is changing, RTE shouldn't change with it. And I think that's perhaps the key to the problem. And I agree with a lot of what Patrick said there. I think that these are small measures to deal with a huge problem. And the question I would ask is, where are the big strategic ideas that have been advanced by management in RTE? What are the big ideas that they have to change with that changing landscape? Because we all recognise the traditional media is suffering a kind of a paucity of attention from particularly younger consumers. And that's true of the print media as much as it is of the broadcast media. So what I would love to see coming from RTE management, rather than is proposals to save a bit of money here and a bit of money there and cut a salary here or take a job away there, what is the big strategic idea that they're putting in place to change the way RTE is doing business, to deal with that change in the landscape and actually make themselves attractive to younger listeners and to people who are not currently tuning into RTE radio or television or whatever it is?
The big message from management, from RTE management today, is that this RTE cannot survive, this cannot work unless the, as what they were calling, the broken licence fee system is reformed. Like, would you agree with that analysis?
Well, no, I mean, certainly I agree that there are problems with the licence scheme, but even if you fixed the fact that about 10 to 13% of people don't pay the licence, you're still only talking 10 to 20 million euro to fix a 50 million.
50 million?
I think 50 million is the gap, but even if you were to fix those, I think that would only raise 10 to 20 million euro, depending on how effective you were to do it. But again, you can always look to that, but the core problem
but
is
why
not,
haven't we looked? I'm trying to understand why we've known about the very high evasion figures that we've had here for many, many years now. And we're now just being told that we're now putting out to tender the
Yeah, but I think you're focusing
collection
on the wrong thing. Even if you look, for example, funding from the government to RTE has increased by 10 million euro in 2018, 2019. But that's not the point either. If RTE is to be viable, and we all hope it is, because this week particularly with the passing of Gay Byrne, we know what a special place RTE has in the hearts and minds of Irish people. If it's to be viable for the next, not just 10 years, 20 years, but the next two, three generations, it's got to modify itself so that funding from the licence fee is no longer its core concern. Its core concern is going to be making itself relevant to the listeners and the watchers around Ireland, making itself attractive to people, making it the kind of thing that they want to consume. That's what will make it viable. desirable. Not reforming the licence fee, however desirable that might be.
Kate Shannon.
I was interested in listening to Richard Bruton on the 6 o'clock this evening to the minister, because it very much gave the impression that there is not going to be any change. He's sticking to the 5 years. Leo Varadkar offered a little bit of hope this evening that it could be changed. But it felt very much like he was talking about a semi-state which had got itself into financial trouble. It needed to trim. And when the government was satisfied that it had trimmed sufficiently, the government would then have a look at it again. I didn't feel as I would be hugely supportive of public service broadcasting, that we're talking about something that's quite different to other parts of the public service, because it has not just its impact internally, but also its impact externally. If you look, for example, at the work that's been done on Brexit by RTE, which I know people in newsrooms in the UK are following the coverage that RTE is giving, because they are having difficulties in understanding what's happening in Europe. So in a way, it's not just about another part of the public service that needs to be trimmed or to be cut. It's also about a vision for a future aligned with a vision for a future of Ireland, which is now going to be, majorly a part of the EU with Brexit and all the rest of it. I didn't feel that. And I think I can agree with you in relation to what you're saying, Barry, about vision, because the impression I get from people I know who work in RTE is that they were looking for a visionary statement. Because if you're going to impose huge cuts, huge change on people to get them to buy into that, there has to be something for them in it. And I'm afraid that the statement this morning, which was very much picked up on all of the negative aspects of it, that sort of vision for the future didn't come across. And that's going to be difficult for RTE in the next 2 to 3 years even, because we're talking about things that could happen in the next 2 to 3 years, which could impact hugely in terms of the service it can provide. I don't think this is the end of cuts. I think they're going to have to make probably far more stringent decisions.
James Lawless.
Yeah, so I suppose from an RTE perspective, I've good news and bad news in terms of what I think. And I am a member of the Communications Committee in the Oireachtas, and we've been looking at this, I suppose, for the last couple of years. We have made a number of recommendations to government, most of which haven't been taken up. But I suppose the fundamental premise I'd start from is that public service broadcasting is a public good which should be protected. And it should be protected with public revenue, and it should be protected as something that, in the same way as schools and hospitals, our national roads network. It's something that we all benefit from in some shape or form, in the era of fake news, in the era of competing. And I suppose I think we're particularly vulnerable in Ireland as well, because we're an English language medium by and large. Obviously, we've read in the Gaeltacht, et cetera, as well. But we're by and large an English medium, which means it's even easier to sweep us and bombard us with Anglophobe, be it American, be it UK content. So that's the good news. Maybe the not so good news for RTE is, one of the concepts we've come around to in the Communications Committee and within Fianna Fáil talking about this is that we believe there should be a public service fund, there should be a broadcasting fund created, which would be supported by public revenue, and be that the broadcasting charge or the TV licence, and we need to collect a lot more of the TV licence because the evasion rates are way too high. But that fund is collected. It doesn't necessarily automatically go to RTE. It would go to domestic content producers. So that fund, so you collect the monies, you ring-fence the monies for public service broadcasting, you then make those available to whoever, anyone and anyone that is doing domestic indigenous content creation, local content. It can be current affairs, it can be news, it can be documentaries, it can be drama, it can be weather, it can be sport. All of the things, to be fair, that RTE do at the moment, and I think by and large do very well. But what's to say a new independent producer, a new independent film studio, a local station, a local radio station may start, and many of them already are doing these things, and they deserve our support as well. So we support public service broadcasting by creating a fund, ring-fencing monies towards it, but then there's a competitive process by which, once you qualify those criteria, if you're doing mass budget, if you're doing, international transatlantic type sitcoms or generic content that you can get anywhere else, no, you don't get a share of that pie. But if you're doing high quality, be it current affairs, be it drama, be it whatever else that is of the type is not available elsewhere, then you can draw down the monies for that. And I think that would be a good way to protect the system going forward and protect local quality contents.
Larry, do you think that people generally. And I think if you anyone was looking, say, online and at the kind of public reaction to this news today, there was not an awful lot of love being displayed towards RTE. Do you think there's an understanding and appreciation of the value of public service broadcasting?
I think in many quarters there is, but I think in some quarters it's been lost. And I think that that's deeply unfortunate. I think all we have to do, anyone who was listening to the radio today, was be to listen to some of the texts and things that were coming in terms of the reaction. Let's be frank, there was not a lot of sympathy out there for Dee Forbes or for RTE today. There was an awful lot of criticism. And to be fair, I think Dee Forbes had a very difficult job to do today. And I know that there wasn't a lot of sympathy for her within this building or outside this building. And Barry's points about the financial challenges remain. I mean, today is maybe the very first step on the road to what is going to need radical surgery down the road. You can't continue to run these kind of deficits and continue to operate. There is a bigger question. I think James' point probably hits on it best in terms of RTE focusing in a very crowded landscape on what it does best, and that is local homegrown things. What is it that makes RTE relevant to, I suppose, younger people? I look at my own stepson. He wouldn't look at RTE if you paid them. And I think there are a lot of people like that in their 20s and their 30s for whom RTE doesn't have the same relevance. Where does it become relevant? It becomes relevant when they get tuned into things like Dublin Murders or To Love Hate. Those are the kind of programming decisions. Those are where the investment, I think, has to go. It's going to be what's homegrown. That's what's going to sustain it or focus on what's uniquely Irish. I think that has to be a part of it. But the bigger picture here, and again, as somebody from outside the jurisdiction, the reality is the people who are begrudging or who are negative on RTE should look at the media landscape elsewhere, perhaps in particular in the United States. We are very, very fortunate to have a public broadcaster who delivers the news and whatever the criticisms there are might be, does not deliver the news in such a way that if you watch two stations, as you do in the United States, you might think you're in a different country or even a different planet just by watching two news stations.
I mean, in terms of that, I mean, there's obviously going to be some tension between the public broadcaster, public service broadcaster, and the government of the day. And, you know, when you hear RTE being picked up and stories and lines being picked up in the Dáil, it's generally from the opposition benches you hear it. And you would think sometimes that maybe the government would quite like a Fox News there to...
not this government.
Why not this government? But this government is, all governments are, and I'm not laying this at your door, obsessed with... how they are covered, and particularly how they are covered on RTE.
Tried to create a 5 million spin machine,
all political parties are concerned with the way they're portrayed in the media. That's natural, because that's very often the way you communicate.
Goes so far as obsessed, maybe.
Well, your word, not mine, Katie. But I agree with what Larry said. I think we can overlook sometimes just how fortunate we are to have a fair and an actual fair and dispassionate media. And I think one of the hardest interviews that we had this morning was with Brian Dobson on Morning Ireland. He pulled no punches at all. And RTE deserves great credit for that. But coming back to what James is saying about supporting public service broadcasting, that already happens. I mean, RTE is funded from public monies to a very, very large extent.
But RTE has not had a licence fee increase since 2008.
Well, last year, the licence fee income went up 10 million euro. There was an uptake in licences last year by 10 million euro. But you can sit around all day, every day, Katie, and bemoan the fact that RTE isn't receiving enough funding, because it'll never receive enough funding to do what it wants to do. And every organisation that's funded by the state everywhere will always want more money, but you cannot continue to pour money into something that isn't working.
Do you think RTE should be radically downsized then?
No, it's not about radical downsizing necessarily. There are certainly areas...
Is there services that we should just... acknowledge
maybe,
we no
maybe
longer
there
should
are,
be in
and there
space.
Are definitely areas where cuts should be made.
Where?
But the answer is
where
well,
should the cuts
I mean,
be
made? I'm not across the RTE. I'm not going to start picking things that should be cut. But what I would say is this. Everybody says the media landscape has changed. We know, for example, even television, with the dawn of things like Netflix, the way people watch television has fundamentally changed. I cannot see a single thing that RTE has done to actually address that. The only thing they have done to look at the online audience is the RTE player, which Dee Forbes herself said is not fit for purpose.
She did not say it's not fit for purpose. She said there are issues. There have been issues.
Well, there are certainly issues. And I can tell you, somebody
issues.
Uses it. Like, for example, Tuesday night, if you wanted to watch the tribute to Gay Byrne, you weren't at your television set in your living room, the service crashed. So what I'm saying is, if you actually want to make yourselves viable and actually something that people want to watch and tune into, these are the issues that need to be addressed. So it's wonderful sitting around this table this evening with intelligent commentary on a particular issue, but you have to be either at, you need to be at a radio or in a particular place to listen to it. What is RTE going to do to broaden its audience and broaden its appeal to make itself viable into the future?
If I could, Kate, interrupt Barry there. I mean, the two most, in terms of innovation and attracting a young audience, the two most innovative public service broadcasters are in Finland and in the BBC. The Finnish have a state tax that everybody pays an amount. They have allowed, you know, stuff to fail, because that's another thing. RT is under huge scrutiny. So if they put on something that's a dud, I mean, they're never going to hear the end of it. But allowing failure, allowing that sort of programming.
Innovation.
Yeah, that programming that's aimed at a young audience. I mean, I've been with students every day for nearly a decade now. They're as interested in current affairs, they're as interested in politics. They are not interested in Irish politics for the most part. They're really interested in international politics. They're following Brexit. RTE is covering Irish politics in a way that no one else will cover it. So when politicians, you know, I feel like it's turkeys voting for Christmas, if they're not going to support RTE, there's very few places that they will be on and be analysed and be made relevant and be important in a democracy. RTE has a lot of changes it needs to do.
But the suggestion, what you're saying, is that politicians don't support RTE, and I don't think that's true. The state supports RTE and politicians.
Barry, I worked in here as a producer. I know, yeah. I know all of the pressures that come on during election time from politicians, the pressures that come on a daily basis from politicians to people in RTE. I've been screamed at by party handlers during the election, you know, in studios like this. So for RTE to be allied to the government, to be, you know, dependent on government for the licence to be in the first place, I don't think that's right. I think in Finland they separated across party. It became very much, it's a tax, part of taxes fairly paid. Once you're allied, and anyway, no matter what party is in government, you're going to see RTE somehow betraying you at various stages when you are giving them a bit of an increase in the licence.
And there's two issues there that we might go. I'm just going to bring you a tweet that just popped up here in front of me. RTE use a panel of established voices, that's you guys, I think, who all benefit from state broadcaster RTE to discuss its future. Another reason RTE needs to go, not a public service broadcaster, it's a state propaganda machine. Try to raise the licence fee and you'll face public revolt. There's two issues. Is that tension that Kate, that I referred to and that Kate just mentioned there, between the people in RTE that need to critically cover the government, and particularly coming up to election around election times, and the fact that you are then beholden to that same government for support and for movement on the licence fee, which has, let's face it, been promised for many years and has been kicked down the road many, many times. And then there's the other fear, that of another water charges type revolt against a tax, a household tax. So is it fear? Is it?
There's also an obvious answer here. I mean, you know, the elephant in the room is the collection rates. So I think the evasion rate in Ireland is something like 15-20%.
It's 10-13%.
It's certainly in the high teens. And internationally, comparative, well, 13%. Let's say it's 13%. Okay, I think it's less than 3% in the UK. In comparative marketplaces, in comparative jurisdictions, it's far lower. We have that 13% translates to, I think it's between 40 to 50 million, which is a significant enough component of the budget. And there are, again, the joint committee, the joint all-party committee made recommendations, I think it was 2.5 years ago at this stage, one of which was that the collection be transferred to revenue, that the collection be maximised. By doing that, and by doing nothing else, by doing that, you could immediately plug an extra 40 to 50 million into the coffers every year. Not as a one-off, but every
your
year.
Wrong,
and that hasn't been done. So that's the joint rocks committee report signed off by all parties. So that's what's
going to be. Can I suggest to you, James, that even if everything you say is right, let's say we plug the 50 million
euro
tomorrow. Okay. Let's say we do that and we plug the hole for now, and then in 5 years' time, the number of people watching and listening to RTE and engaging with RTE goes down again. What have we done? You can't continue to do the same thing over and over again and expect something to come out differently.
And exactly.
You have to change the way RTE is approaching its market. Because if talking about the ideas that you yourself espouse of having greater home programming and investing in indigenous programming.
Maybe missed the point there. So I might come back into that. I mean, I think probably I proposed a fairly radical idea, which is saying that we have a public service broadcasting fund, but that is not an RTE tax. That is not an RTE levy. Mm. That is not an RTE subsidy. That is a fund that is put into a pot, and any organisation that producing quality content that satisfies a certain criteria, which may include RTE and probably would initially be the lion's share, but could very easily, over time, you could see a situation where a decade hence, RTE wouldn't even qualify for any of it, depending on how the programme schedule lined up.
Two problems with
so that's
what
very
you're
different
saying,
to what
James.
You're talking about.
Yeah. First of all, it's not all that radical. It's an idea that's been around for a while. The first problem is that if you say...
And your government
still
haven't done it.
It's just... we've already heard about the licensing issues that have gone over decades in several governments. So it's not about a single government, and nor should it be. But the point I'm making is, firstly, you cannot simply solve the funding problem and expect things to change and expect RTE to be viable in the long term. But the second problem with what you're suggesting by creating a fund that only funds a particular type of programming is the law of unintended consequences means that you steer money in a particular direction that may not necessarily make RTE, for example, viable. So, for example, the reality is the audiences out there want more than just Love, Hate or Dublin Murders, however good they may be. And we all think that they're triumphs in terms of what they have done.
I've completely lost my way in Dublin Murders, but carry on.
Maybe. But the point I'm making is if you decide, for example, to ring-fence all the money that's collected in respect of the licence fee and provide it only, for example, for Indigenous programming, then you'll find the audience will desert the Indigenous stations because they want to see programming from outside Ireland as well. And Kate mentioned that as well, and the news is a prime example of it. But even going beyond that into drama and things like that, they want to see products that are more than just Irish, and they're not just necessarily British and American.
So,
but if you ring fence that money, you abandon the audience.
I think, Barry, maybe you're maybe misinterpreting or misunderstanding the point. The Public Service Broadcasting Fund services and funds public service broadcasting material. If the organisations that draw down from that fund choose to commission, buy, go out on the market and buy from Netflix or buy from the States or buy from wherever else they want to, other programs and use advertising revenue or other revenues that they've commercially raised to do that, good luck to them. There is nobody saying that this public service broadcasting fund is the only content that would be available on Irish channels. The free market applies to everything else. But public service broadcasting is a public good. It should be ring-fenced. It's not about saving RTE. It's about saving public service broadcasting, being a public good. And if they want to subsidise that, as RTE does at the moment, and as other producers do with advertising revenue and other forms of revenue, best of luck.
Kate, I think there's a place for a fund. Absolutely. It has worked in terms of some of the programming that's coming out via the BA Sound and Vision. The problem is that the consistency that a public service broadcaster gives you would not be available in this fund. And I can see immediately the same people who this morning were saying, I mean, the public could not cut the RTE salaries enough. If you told them in the morning that Ryan
Tubby
they'd say he wasn't paying enough to be on RTE. I mean, that is how the public
tweet here, RTE reduced the stupid bloody wages being paid to some staff. That would be a start. Is RTE series, another text we just got in, looking for extra public money to fund the huge salaries? The sense of entitlement is amazing. RTE, who I'm obviously listening to, is not an essential utility as water supply is. It can be done without. It is time that staff and management realise that we like you, but we can do without you.
The problem I was going to finish there, and I mean that's reflecting a lot of the stuff that was on social media when the story was broken last night by the Irish Times. But the other issue in relation to the creation of programming is that as soon as the commercial broadcasters are given funding, there will be a kickback against that as well, because you'll be saying, why are you financing people who are going on to make profits that are not, you know, that are going to a company? It's not going back into wherever it's supposed to go to. So you're always going to have difficulties. Places like in Denmark, where they did fantastic TV programmes, you know, most of their really great filmmakers worked in television, the national television or film school there. It literally was a conduit to all of the stuff like The Bridge, all the great programmes that they made. The government there decides to withdraw their support for a broadcasting a licence fee because it didn't like some of the political work that was being done by Danish state television. So you can see immediately that it's not a matter of fighting one battle and then changing things. A public service broadcaster builds up something over time, and it builds up a trust. Even if the public hate you, they still trust you to a certain extent.
I just want to let Larry in. Yes. I just to explain to people why we haven't been hearing from Harry. He got a bit delayed, but we're expecting him momentarily. But Larry.
Yeah, first thing I should say, just by way of input, is I'm sure some commentators will say it if I haven't said it. My wife works in RTE, so do disclosure, hands up on that one before somebody takes a shot at me, which I know they will. But one of the things, and I think everyone else has done a good job of outlining the myriad problems that I think face RTE, And I think we can problematize all these things and dwell on them forever, because they are serious problems that are going to take a long time to get to grips with as the media landscape changes greatly. But what do I think we should be doing, I suppose, in the medium to short term? I think it's been some time since the license fee went up. I know that that's anathema, and I have some sympathy for politicians who dare to bring this up, because I know the depth of public opposition to it. But I do think there is space for a moderate increase in the license fee, as anathema as that might be to some people. And that should be done in the name of RTE, I suppose, refocusing and recalibrating and doing the things that it does best, and focusing and then focusing that it's not going to have the audiences that Gay Byrne does, but it provides a very, very important service. And part of that is a public relations job as well, to get that message out. I know RTE does some of that already, but to get that message out that we do have a reliable, strong state broadcaster. And again, look at the alternative. Look at what's out there. People here are very fond of lampooning to me Fox News and other things, but the same people who might lampoon Fox News will also be very, very critical of RTE. So I think holding the mirror up is important as well.
I just finally got a supportive text in on RTE. Katie, the politician is wrong. I think that was that's yourself, Barry.
I'm sure it was James.
The content is excellent. RTE Player is shockingly bad, but overall content is great. The focus on a few highly paid presenters that deserve their salary is unfair. We must think of the ordinary worker that is caught up and brandished with the same brush. We need to support our national broadcaster, as it does provide content that is public service content. That's Damien in Galway.
Yeah, that couldn't be me, because I was saying how great the content was. I was at pains to do that.
Ultimately, what we learned today, we're Airtel going, much as I have huge affection for it because it gave me my start, I don't think there's going to be anyone out on the streets campaigning to retain it. And, you know, even the issue of Lyric that was floated, that was put to bed, and Lyric is being retained. I'm just thinking, we're still looking at low-hanging fruit here. And are we, like, the 60 million... It seems to me, adding up from the salaries that are going to get the 15% cut and the 10% from the exec, we seem to be a long way off of the 60 exactly. million by my calculations.
Yeah, which is why we need to look at a more fundamental root and branch reform that's going to change the way that RTE operates, and it's going to address the deficit that it has.
But does the government not need to work with RTE in selling the message that there is a value, this is a valuable service that if it's lost will have serious consequences
It strikes me that we're actually seeing a lot of kite flying over the last couple of years, and it seems that every so often there's this kind of big shock horror, oh my God, RTE in huge cuts, somebody better do something. And it's, you know, whether it's the art pieces from the walls, whether it's a piece of land in Montrose, whether it's the orchestras under threat. Lyric was the biggest kite flying, I think, of all, because, you know, potentially maybe decision makers and policymakers listen to Lyric and would be aghast at the thought it might be done away with. So what better way to get their attention than to threaten their favourite radio station?
It was a ransom note.
I think it might have been, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. And look, I mean, I suppose, is that the solution? It's not, it draws attention to it, but, you know, if there's going to be a big ask, come out with the big ask rather than throwing all these little baubles around the place to try to get attention.
But is it helpful on a day when these cuts are being announced and there's a discussion opening up about the future of RTE, the future of public service broadcasting, if the ministers that are sent out, like Patrick O'Donovan's main line, is an attack line saying RTE needs to grow its commercial revenue in a landscape where we know this is an almost impossible task?
I don't think that's all that Patrick said. I think it was much broader than that.
He said save Limerick as well.
Yeah, well, and that's an important message for him to give as well. But
he said we should have death notices. That would be public service broadcasting.
The point that he's making is largely the point that I'm trying to make as well. It's not just about plugging the financial hole. Yes, there's a financial hole that needs to be dealt with. But at the end of the day, if you've plugged that hole, what's the future for RTE if you haven't addressed the reason that that hole emerged in the first place? And so that's what RTE needs to decide. What does it want to be, and how's it going to get there?
Okay.
I don't know if you can have this. I mean, the lean broadcasting, you know, that sort of flexible lean machine, and the public service broadcaster, they don't necessarily go together, because the whole notion of the public service broadcaster is there are certain things you have to cover that cost an awful lot of money.
And that aren't necessarily commercially viable.
They're not commercially viable. And I'm looking at, you know, what the BBC has done. I mean, fantastic things like their local democracy initiative, where they have, you know, they're subsidising local reporters around the country. You've vast swathes of the UK which don't get coverage at the moment. You've courts not being covered across the UK. You've courts not being covered across Ireland because reporters aren't being assigned to those beats anymore. There's a lot of stuff happening, and I recently had to do a piece for an academic book on the Celtic Tiger and recalling it, and mine was the media section. And one of the things I said in it was that there are drum beats that occur when a democracy is under threat, that if they're not being covered by good journalism, we ignore them at our peril. And you know, we heard on Liveline today the kind of stuff that's happening to kids, you know, racist stuff. We know what's happening up at the border, things that have to be covered in a way that could affect all of our futures. And I know every time RT talks about, you know, democracy, and every time people like me come on and talk about it, I can hear the people coming in saying, oh, well, they would say that, wouldn't it? They're all in it together. They're all fat cats.
They're all looking after each other.
Yeah, state TV and all the rest of it. But when a society breaks down, and Larry's made a very good point, and when it becomes so divided, as it is in the UK at the moment, as it is in the US, the consequences of that are incredible.
Absolutely.
Okay, on that note, we will take a break and we will come back and talk about a related issue, perhaps, which is fake news and how we deal with it after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back in studio tonight. We have Larry Donnelly, Kate Shanahan, James Lawless, Barry Ward. We are at any moment apparently going to be joined by Harry McGee from the Irish Times. And now we're moving on because an international committee on fake news and disinformation involving members of 12 parliaments met in Dublin today. The Facebook executive before the committee, Monica Burkert, said that Facebook should not be the truth police for the whole world. That was in defence of their policies on political advertising, which have been the source of some controversy of late. But Robert McNamee, author of Zucked, Facing Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, had this to say.
Right now, there are no disincentives for bad behavior. Yeah. So we need to scale up the punishments by perhaps two orders of magnitude. They need to be measured in trillions, not billions. The companies need to understand that failure, that undermining democracy should be punishable by extermination of the company. There is no reason why any company should have the right to be an enabler of the destruction of the society in which it lives. If you make personal data a human right and therefore not an asset that can be traded, that will take care of this problem.
And that was Roger McNamee there, who was at one time a mentor of Mark Zuckerberg, but now has become a big campaigner for the breakup of Facebook. And we are joined by Harry McGee.
Fashionably late.
Very fashionably late. Thank you, Harry. I just want to go to you, James, because you were at that committee. You're a member of the International Committee.
Mm-hmm.
What was achieved by today's meeting?
Yeah, so today is the third meeting of the International Committee. I suppose the International Committee was founded 12 months ago, primarily Damien Collins, who's the chair of the UK committee, Bob Zimmer, chair of the Canadian committee. And it's grown. Ireland were involved pretty much from the start, but we're now up to 12 countries. There are, I suppose, two things are happening. There's a recognition that this is an issue that is larger than any one country, that the tech platforms, the tech giants are global in scale and reach and resources, and each country can try to legislate and regulate on its own, but we're stronger together. And at the same time, there's a leadership vacuum because we see those in maybe senior leadership positions. So President Trump isn't exactly the poster boy for tackling fake news. Many would say he got elected on the back of it. We see in parallel in the UK, the current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, it was a very interesting tweet yesterday. It's the first time I mentioned the committee this morning. First time I've seen an official campaign account for a mainstream political party running a deep fake. There was a distorted ad of Keir Starmer, the Labour Party Brexit spokesperson, in a very mocked up and false, basically, video ad that this Conservative Party were running. Up to now, it's been kind of fringe groups, it's been anonymous groups, you know, running those kind of deep fakes.
And I saw James Cleverly out yesterday, was it yesterday morning, the morning before, defending it robustly and saying this is satirical and we're entitled to do this.
They're stretching credulity, really, but I suppose it's no surprise because Dominic Cummings, who was the brainchild behind the Vote Leave campaign, he used all kinds of nefarious micro-targeting and sophisticated social media techniques, is now the brains behind number 10. So you have a need to regulate an international level. At the same time, with international leaders, maybe are not best placed to take that on. So the Grand Committee, one of the outcomes of today, and I was keen that we, at the Irish meeting, that we do this, that we begin to tie down actions because we can talk and we can deliberate, but it's really important that we begin to go beyond that. So we put in place a number of initiatives. One is that each country, all 12 countries that took part today, signed off and their home parliaments, our committees agreed to this, a number of principles. one of which the each country would try to legislate for disclosure on political advertising. If a political ad is being run, this is a legislation I introduced here 2 years ago, but a number of countries are trying to do it, that there's disclosure around it so that the message is independent. Your freedom of speech says you can say whatever you want to say, but tell us who's saying it, and then people can make up their own informed choices. We talked about micro-targeting. Why is micro-targeting bad? So micro-targeting is where you zoom in a particular segment, you know, 45 to 55-year-olds living in Bray who drive Hondas, who like to go for walks on the seaside, and let's show them ads for, I don't know, something that's relevant to that sector. Yeah. And the problem with that is because...
When you say all these countries signed off, like what's the status of that sign-off then?
So I suppose what we had today, the Grand Committee is a committee of parliamentarians. So as in MPs, TDs, senators, congressmen, whatever their home title is, but pretty much elected members of parliament in each state. So they have committed, and on behalf of their home committees, so it's a parliamentary initiative as opposed to a government initiative, but they have each signed off. They will make best endeavours to make this happen in their home states and their domestic legislatures.
To make best endeavours. Is that as far as we
Well, we're not governments. You know, we are parliamentary committees. We can pass motions. We can bring forward legislation. None of us have executive power. I suppose as parliamentary committees, the best we can do is make reports, make recommendations, like we've done on broadcasting, like we've done on social media in the past. Governments, unfortunately, we see this a lot domestically. I don't want to focus on the domestic agenda because this is an international issue. But unfortunately,
can I go to that? Because it's an international issue. Yeah. But of course, there's a huge issue for us in Ireland because big social media platforms are here.
Yeah.
And Helen Dixon, with the best will in the world, cannot possibly have the resources to police all of this.
I think Helen Dixon actually is maybe one of the few silver linings, or one of the few light at the end of the tunnel here, because the one body at the moment that actually does have clout, maybe not enough resources, but does have resources and has some sanctions, is Helen Dixon and the Data Protection Commissioner. Because right now they do have the legislative framework.
As I say, with the best will in the world, it cannot possibly deal with the scale of
needs more resources, but at least she's got some powers and laws, because the other areas don't. I mean, if you run a bogus political ad, there is nothing at the moment in law to stop you. If you have foreign revenue funding that ad, there's nothing to stop you. Pretty much anywhere in the right now, there is no law on political advertising in Ireland. I introduced one to the Dáil 2 years ago, which passed by a majority vote, which has been scrutinised by the committee, which has been given the approval from the Parliamentary Legal Advisor. The government has sat on their hands.
Let Barry Ward respond to that.
The Standards and Public Office Commission does. I mean,
What about that legislation? Why has that not progressed?
Which legislation is that?
The legislation that James Lawless introduced.
I was delighted, actually. One of the things that I think was quite exciting today was that Richard Bruton talked about putting more responsibility back onto the platform holders.
Could you just respond to the question?
What I'm saying is that James put forward a private members bill, and I'm not pretending to be across the detail of it, but the reality is that it's not something that is easily implemented. I think that the reason that we need to take more steps towards putting the responsibility back onto the platform holders themselves, like Facebook, like Twitter. These are multi-billion euro corporations.
What Facebook's attitude is. I just have a very quick clip from Monica Burkhardt, who was the executive before that committee today.
We don't think that Facebook should be the truth police for the entire world, and we should not determine for citizens what they shall and shall not see in terms of truthfulness from their politicians.
Harry McGee, you were covering this
today. Yeah, I listened to it all day, and it was fascinating. And it's the third such meeting, as James said. And James, at the press conference afterwards, said, "Nín yarth go curla céile." You know, when parliamentarians come together, they have succeeded in putting some pressure on the big tech companies. But we are seeing there a divide or a chasm between Facebook and between other social media companies. Last week, Twitter announced that it was banning all political ads, and there was an expectation that perhaps Facebook would follow suit, but it hasn't. So what Facebook has done is that it has increased transparency in relation to some political ads, and it has required that they be verified in some countries, but not all countries. And then they've also provided information for people to find out who's behind the ads and who else they're sharing them with. But critically, they have refused. And they've also started doing fact-checking on some of the assertions that are made in ads, but crucially, not when politicians are speaking or when they're expressing opinions. That remains a scrutiny-free zone, and that's where the fault lies. And one of the interesting things that came out of the committee today that they decided, it's not in the principles that James outlined, but it was decided by, I think, 7 of the 9 groups of parliamentarians today, is that they're going to try to get governments in their countries to put a moratorium on these type of ads, where they focus in on very small segments of people and then disseminate false information.
That's just in the days before an election, or a total...
Well, they want them to put a moratorium to try to introduce legislation to put a moratorium on that type
micro-targeting.
I'm wondering, is that in the run up to an election? Because we know, and we've been told that in the days, the last hours, 24 hours, 48 hours of the Brexit campaign, that there was a massive campaign that micro-targeted a lot of voters.
Happening right now as well.
Yeah, but sure, and I'm sure it's going to happen in the British election. We had an example of it yesterday, and anyone should listen to the interview that Nick Ferrari did with James Cleverly afterwards, where James Cleverly tried to defend it as a piece of comedy or as a piece of satire. So we're seeing instances of that. We saw it in the referendum campaign for Brexit with the likes of Dominic Cummings and others behind it. And we've also seen it in America in several instances in recent years. I think there's a very compelling argument for it. But there's also a difficulty that if you bring in legislation that targets at these, it might have unforeseen consequences as well. There are small groups who are trying to defend human rights, who are trying to operate in countries where there are no democracies. And the difficulty is that if you start introducing the kind of bars and the kind of prohibitions that were discussed about, the unforeseen consequences is that those groups might be affected as well.
Larry.
Harry's latter point there is very well made, and it's one of the things that Facebook is going to cling on to. And I also think it's important to make a distinction between Twitter's action and Facebook's ongoing refusal. For Twitter, political advertising was a very, very small item in terms of the overall budget, whereas for Facebook, it's a moneymaker for them. And James, notwithstanding the work of James' committee and of a really good piece in the Irish Times today, urging global cooperation and global regulation. Harry talks about a chasm. And one of the things that was evident in the clip you just played from Facebook is a chasm with respect to speech. And that's a chasm from which the social media companies emanate. And that is that Silicon Valley American mindset where all speech is accorded protection, where everything and anything can be said, and any regulation against that is something to be pushed and marginalized against because of the radical interpretation accorded the First Amendment in the United States, both in politics and media and elsewhere. That's the gulf or the chasm between regulation in Europe versus regulation in the United States. That's going to be a real tough battle to reconcile.
But isn't there a problem that in the US, I mean, one of the co-founders of Facebook has said that he wished it was broken up, that it has become an inhibitor to innovation, that it has become too big to control, big to fail.
I'll just give you a line
Europe is the only place now that we can actually stop this.
Mm. Roger McNamee, that we heard the clip from at the top, he wrote the book Zucked, which is a brilliant takedown of the whole background and history of Facebook. And he talks about invasive surveillance, careless sharing of private data, the behaviour modification in pursuit of unprecedented scale and influence.
They need the information. Their commercial model is they need the information to be able to sell it on. They developed the algorithm. And this is one thing that scientists who have worked for Facebook and data scientists have said, we could actually change things, but we don't want to. There's no reason for us to do it. And unless the Europeans, and I think James and his committee are on the right road, unless we decide as a continent
we're not asking, as you said, for Facebook to be the truth police of the world. We're asking them to be the truth police for themselves. Yeah. And the reality is, as Larry said, they're making money out of every ad, every click, every video and all the rest is played. It's not unreasonable to ask them also to fund a bit of responsible action towards that and take much greater responsibility.
They take no personal responsibility. Yeah. They have no ethical standards the same way as newspapers or publishers.
But they say they are not publishers. That's their fundamental point.
They are changing that view themselves. That discussion is being had at higher levels, where they recognise that they are actually responsible in some way for what goes out. But it depends on how far you push them. They will look at things like terrorism, child abuse. They may take some kind of actions on those. But in relation to politics, they are not going to take anything on it because it's a huge money spinner.
So asking them to take responsibility seems to me to be a bit naive, really, given what we've seen, how they respond, what their model is.
So what do we need? They abdicate responsibility for their own.
No,
platform.
But I'm saying, do we not need to enforce
exactly the kind of thing that's been talked
but
about?
We've let the legislation that has been produced.
Legislation is not a panacea either. The reality is what Richard Bruton said today is we need to be putting pressure back onto the platforms and saying you need to take responsibility. And maybe that is, going beyond. Maybe it is taking on politics. Although I think politics is a much bigger money spinner in the United States than it is here in real terms.
But we have a problem that we rely on the Facebooks and the Twitters and all of those big social media firms for so many jobs, so much FDI into Ireland,
don't think that comes into play at all, because this is a global issue. It's not just about Ireland. And yes, Helen Dixon has an important role and has a hugely enhanced role.
And does she have enough resources to fulfil that role?
Well, given the size of Facebook and Twitter...
Because she did come out recently and say she did not have anything near the resources.
She could ever have enough resources to police.
No, she was very clear about the level of resources she had asked for and were refused.
But she will never have enough resources. You can never have enough resources. Look at every page on Facebook, which is why, Katie, which is why you need to put that responsibility back onto the platform. If they want to operate as a business, they must take responsibility.
She said today that there are three or more ongoing investigations into micro-targeting that the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner are doing, looking at the effect it has on personal users, looking at what they call data dealing, where data is mined or scraped then distributed, and then ad exchanges where people collect inventories or collect huge databases and then flog them off to be sent to the man down in Bray with a Honda Civic who's 50 years of age or whatever. Those very small, minute groups of potential voters that they're going to go afterwards. But the critical thing is that Facebook still regards itself as a platform rather than a publisher. And until that mindset has changed completely, I think we're not going to get really anywhere with them.
I think that's the reason I think that we need to move, as Harry says, change the mindset. But unfortunately, the tech giants, and particularly Facebook, are not going to change mindsets, and they're not going to change voluntarily. And that's why self-regulation is no regulation. And that's why it is up to regulators, it is up to governments, because governments are the ones that have the power to do it, to actually pass laws, to pass regulations, to actually mandate them to behave in the way we expect them and want them to behave. What is coming out of the hearings today, I think what's coming out of patterns over the last maybe year or two, Facebook are becoming more of an outlier. Twitter, I think, were to an extent the good boys in the class, all along. There was an issue with maybe angry tweets and bots a couple of years ago. That was tidied up. Google have kind of kept the head down. But by and large, they have brought in their own rules. They brought in their own bans. So again, we saw this week Twitter banning political advertising across the board. Facebook are lagging behind. Facebook probably had initially, still do have far bigger global audiences. They're also still expanding into developing countries and expanding markets. But I'm beginning to think they've actually peaked in some jurisdictions in terms of the user growth, in terms of the user base. And I think people are beginning to actually run the rule over it themselves. And people are actually they're more informed, they're more educated, they're aware of these issues. So Facebook in particular, it's kind of almost on the way, and it's almost peaked and it's on the way back down again. Certainly in this, I suppose, in more mature jurisdictions.
I want to move on from that, but before I go, it had just been reminded of the controversy with the Strategic Communications Unit and the idea that the idea of a government which had to stand down, disband its own Strategic Communications Unit on the back of a controversy of running ads in local papers that weren't clearly marked as advertorial, to be demanding transparency from...
I think they're unrelated issues, but I mean
they aren't, actually,
and it comes back to what James says. They won't.
If the issue is about transparency, about political advertising, advertising.
This is the point. James said, for example, they won't change or they won't change voluntarily. It can't be both. The reality is they have already changed their position. We've heard about changes they made, for example, in respect of certain grotesque content that is on Facebook. Facebook is now rowing back and they're taking that stuff offline. In this jurisdiction, for example, you can't put political ads up on Facebook without going through a fairly rigorous authorization and verification process. Those changes have been made. Now, if you want to step back, political pressure applied by governments, yes,
but not by governments, yes,
by governments and NGOs, James. But if you want to sit back and say, well, they're never going to change, so therefore we'll just accept that. I don't accept that. And
that's not the point I was making, Gary Ward. I was making the point that if you're asking others to be transparent about where they might turn around to you and say, well, that is rich coming from people who had to break up their own communications unit.
For exactly that. One issue. Politics in Ireland is actually tremendously transparent. If you want to talk about transparency, everything we do is open to scrutiny by the media, by state agencies, by the Standards and Public Office Commission. There's huge transparency. And there's a real danger when you suggest that there isn't, that people get the wrong idea about it. The reality is every meeting the government has with these people is published. It's available online to anybody. There was a register of lobbying that was brought in by a government in this country. So the transparency is there. But the difference is whether you're just going to accept that nothing can be done or you're going to step in and say you have to take responsibility.
In terms of form but not in substance, when you read through the lobbying register, the amount of information you get is quite sparse.
Yeah, it's not perfect, but
inadequate. I know that it's a move in the right direction.
You're not saying that there isn't transparency. There is transparency.
There is, but perhaps not quite enough.
Okay, I'm going to have to take a break, my last break, but stay with us because we want to talk about what's happening in the States and those impeachment hearings after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And we just have a few minutes. And I want to go to yourself, Larry, because you're probably more familiar than this than the rest of us. The public hearings that we're expecting next week, that we've obviously known, and there's been a lot of reporting around the private hearings before three different committees in the run-up to this. But next week, we'll see the first public hearings in this impeachment process.
Yeah, and we're going to hear from, among others, the former U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, and who knows what is going to come up and emerge from that questioning. And who knows, one of the things I think that will be important to watch will be to see how House Republicans react to this. If there is any wavering among House Republicans, that's the key thing to watch. Remember, when it came to authorizing the impeachment inquiry, all of the Republicans voted against it. If there is any driftage, that will give us a sense as to whether the prospect exists for any drift in the United States Senate when this thing, as I anticipate it will.
Well, we saw that Lindsey Graham is saying, I'm not even going to bother to read the transcripts. This is a fake process.
Well, there is that. And again, politics is much more partisan now than it was in the Watergate era. At the same time, however, things do gather momentum. There is a head of steam that these things can gather. So to say that this definitely won't happen, they definitely won't be removed from office, I'm not there. I think it's a remote possibility, but it is still in the ether, and we'll wait to see what happens in the House.
Harry, could this actually just help his re-election prospects?
It could, and I would still say he's a favourite to win the election in 2020 at this moment of time, even though there are certain people on the Democrat side who are coming forward, like Elizabeth Warren, who seems to be making more of an impact now. I don't think he's going to be. I mean, there's an attempt to impeach Bill Clinton as well. The difficulty for the Democrats will be in the Senate, where they need a two-thirds majority in the Senate. And I just don't think that's going to happen unless there's some really dramatic revelations that come out.
Have you been following it, Kate?
I've been following it. Funny, because there was a Facebook link tonight that one of the whistleblowers has been named on Facebook and was brought to their attention. They had to take him down because, you know, no one knows if he actually is the person involved, but also not all of the sites in the States, particularly, you know, the kind of 4chan type sites, were giving personal details about this man so that people could find his house and all the rest.
He's being doxxed.
The one thing I always think of when I look at those situations and, you know, looking back to various whistleblower type scenarios, it's the people who are caught up in it, who are not necessarily, who are Republican with a small R, if I could put it like that, who will find themselves giving evidence about stuff that they know may end up having them, you know, their reputations destroyed. So you never know what's going to come out in these scenarios. Like the ambassador's evidence, for example.
The EU ambassador's evidence that was completely revised
exactly
in the last few days, to put it kindly.
The person who was coming up today was a woman who listened into the conversation. The fact that they're now saying that the one whistleblower is currently working with the CIA, that it's the incremental build-up of this. I don't think it will affect Trump's chances, but I think Larry is right. It's how Republicans will react to it.
Will be what we'll all be watching, and I'm afraid that is all we have time for tonight. Just time for one headline from the Irish Examiner. And that truck driver heard knocking from his trailer. That's the truck driver of that trailer with the 15 people who were found in the back. He's been released, it says here, without charge in England. And the headline as well on that front page is "Change consent in rape laws, say experts." I want to thank my panel for joining us tonight. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by Abby Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Harry Booklis was on sound. And now it's over to Carl Murray on Late Date.